Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Are you looking for relief, relaxation, or to party on the motherfucking moon? Then check out 3Chi's new True Strains lineup of cannabis vapes and gummies tailored for specific effects. And the best part? It's delivered straight to your door. Visit 3Chi.com. That's 3CHI.com. And for a limited time, get 20% off with the code BARSTOOL20.
This week's episode of Zero Block 30 is brought to you by a new show on the CW Network, man. Like, I don't know if you have the Charlie Whiskey Network on TV, but they have a new military series, and I'm stoked. Cons, you want to know why I'm stoked? I'm even going to bring Cons in the ad rate.
Tell me why you're stoked.
Because I love shows that intermingle fantasy, not even fantasy, but like real life with fiction life. Mm-hmm. So at first I was like, oh, this is just another like military hostage show where they rescue people. But then they mentioned Bo Bergdahl's name, like, mm-hmm. in it. So whenever they bring in real elements, you're just like, oh, fuck, man. I don't know. Is this real life? Like, whenever those lines get blurred just a little bit, it makes the show much more interesting. And just from the trailer, I've only seen a trailer, but I'm excited when it actually comes out, because there's not very many military-related shows that I even give a fuck about, really.
No, right, because a lot of them are basically strictly fiction. But like you said, I enjoy when there's a little bit of crossover, when it's fiction, but it's based in some kind of current event or facts. So I think Valor's going to be a good watch.
Yeah, and I'll just read their normal ad read. Two special ops army helicopter. Two special ops helicopter pilots breaking down the boundaries and defying all expectations. Their bravery in the face of impossible odds earned them distinguished flying cross for Valor. But put together, they're finding the truth. Is that the first casualty of war. During their last mission, something went wrong, incredibly wrong, something no one is talking about. And they went to the combat zone, not everyone came home. So now they have their secrets. But they're also patriots and refuse to leave any man behind. What would you do if you had to break the rules to do what's right? Would you stay grounded and step in line, or go to any length to earn that truth? They share secrets, go on clandestine missions, risk their lives and limb with only each other to depend on. How close would you get to the only person who really knows you? It's an explosive new drama that pushes the boundaries between military discipline and human nature. That series is right on target. Valor, the world premiere, after the season premiere of Supergirl, Monday, only on the Charlo Whiskey, the CW. Sounds pretty dope, dude. Like, yeah. I can't wait. All right, so this is the Vietnam episode. Brandon, cue up that Vietnam music. All right, man, so later on in the show, we have Captain Jack Higgins, which is probably the most military name I've ever
heard. I was just going to say, what a badass name that is.
I mean, fucking Tom Clancy couldn't wrote a better name than Jack Higgins to come in and talk about Vietnam, and he does a great job. Connor, how you doing, my man?
I'm doing excellent, and I am stoked that we finally, and shame on us for taking this long, but we finally had a Vietnam vet on, and he did a fantastic job. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this interview, and as Chaps and I have said before, we really do appreciate veterans of all wars, but we especially sometimes want to highlight the Vietnam War just because those guys didn't get the proper due when they came home, and you'll find out when we
Vietnam
talk to
Vietnam and Korea got fucked.
So it was great to have Captain Higgins.
Yeah, it was, man. Like, just a really good talk. I mean, just to give you the highlights real quick, we went over the Pete Burns documentary that is going over Vietnam, 18 hours long. It seems good. Like, and he had mixed kind of emotions about it. It's a really interesting story. He told his story of how he got the Purple Heart over in Vietnam, and he told the story about how his platoon went and basically saved a Navy Cross recipient after he had been badly injured. Pretty incredible story. I can't wait for you guys to hear it later on in the show. But we would definitely be remiss if we didn't talk about what happened in Vegas this week, because I feel like, because we're the military voice here, especially on the Barstool Network, we have a little bit of responsibility to explain things that in our way. And we've talked numerous times. I'm not a fucking gun guy, like, as far as knowing every single tactical issue about a gun, the technical aspects of gun. That's not who I am. That's not who you are, right?
No, not at all. I mean, I was thinking about it today. I haven't even fired a weapon since I left the military. I think I might have fired a bow and arrow, but that's about it. But I haven't fired a semi-automatic weapon since I left the military.
Yeah, I have a pellet gun that I shoot squirrels from in my backyard because I like to feed them to my dogs. It's kind of a cool little snack for my dogs. But I never hit them because my pellet gun fucking sucks. But that's neither here nor there. So the main story, you've heard and read articles about everything, and which is something that I fucking hate, that you make basically the shooter into a bona fide celebrity, like where every single aspect of his life is known now.
Yeah, I mean, they go super in-depth. And it's a curiosity of and human nature of people just to want to know the why. I got to be honest, I didn't read really a single thing beyond any headlines about him. I didn't care. The fact remains he did a horrible thing, and that's all that matters. The fact that he did that horrible thing. I don't really care who he was in his past life or who he was living with or any of that nonsense. So I didn't get past any of those headlines. So I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I just don't give a fuck about him or anything. One thing that I do care about and wanted to kind of give our perspective on what the difference is between just a slow pull weapon, a semi-automatic weapon, and then you have your automatic weapon.
Right.
So a one-shot weapon, what would that be?
So a semi-automatic weapon typically is what we carry in the military. I carried an M4. Chaps, I think you had an M4, right? Or you had something else?
Yeah, I had a couple different, but yeah, M4 primarily.
M4, and when you think about a semi-automatic, what that means is one trigger pull will fire one round or bullet. Now, on an M4 and certain rifles, you'll have an option to have a three-round burst, but for all intents and purposes, a single round is being fired through a semi-automatic weapon, and every time you want to fire a round, you have to pull that trigger. Now, obviously, you could just sit there with your finger and see how fast you can pull, and that's how fast you can fire on a semi-automatic weapon. But then when you talk about a fully automatic weapon, when you're talking about a 240 Bravo, a 249 Saw, squad automatic weapon, when you hold that trigger down, rounds will fire until you release your finger from that trigger. Now, you're taught to shoot in about a 10-round or thereabout burst, because if you just hold your finger down, you'll actually melt the barrel. But the mechanism is such that as long as your
finger... Die Fuzzy Bunny. That's a Die Fuzzy Bunny pull.
There you go. So long as your finger is applying pressure to that trigger, it will fire rounds. And that's what an automatic weapon is.
So what I mean by that is you pull it as long as you say, Die Fuzzy Bunny, Die Fuzzy Bunny, Die Fuzzy Bunny. And that's going to hit out a pretty significant spray of rounds.
Right.
So an automatic weapon... I think the best way to explain this, before we get into it, what's a bump stock? Because that's what everybody's been talking about this week, is that this guy didn't have an automatic weapon. He had a bump stock. Explain what a bump stock is.
So a bump stock is an attachment to a semi-automatic weapon. Now, if you break down a semi-automatic weapon, it comes into a bunch of different parts. But just imagine for a minute that a semi-automatic is just one part. When you attach the bump stock, then it effectively becomes two parts. And what it does is it allows that semi-automatic weapon, it does not change the mechanical operation of the weapon. So there's still only one round being fed into the chamber with each pull. But what it does is it uses the recoil of the weapon when you fire. And it's so long as you are applying pressure on the barrel of the weapon forward and your finger is held pressure on the trigger, it will continue to fire. So in essence, it speeds up that process that you would just be using your finger to pull the trigger. It speeds that process up. And when you listen to that sound on the Vegas shooting, that's why it sounds like there was an automatic weapon firing, because the rate of fire was increased by using the bump stock.
Right. And I've watched a couple of videos because I wasn't super familiar with a bump stock before. And the biggest thing that people say about a bump stock is that it decreases your accuracy because it moves everything around. You're not going to be able to keep a tight group. A tight group meaning that, like, if you shoot from 25 meters or 25 yards away, that you're going to be able to basically keep it inside your fist. You cannot do that with a bump stock, no matter how good of a shot you are.
Right.
It's going to basically spray. But whenever you're using it like these, like the guy there did in Vegas, or like a terrorist would in a general direction, you don't need to be a precision shooter. You just have to spray the bullets.
Right, and that big of a crowd, happens.
It doesn't – when you're going to – like, that's why saying that a bump stock or something like that is for one, targets is completely fucking asinine, and two, for hunting, you're not going to spray a general area with bullets when you're going after a deer, because if you're a good shot, you're going to completely eviscerate the deer, or you're not going to be able to eat that motherfucker. So
right.
That, it makes no sense why you would ever even need something like that.
I have no idea. I'd never heard about it when I was in the military, and truth be told, I didn't hear about it until this incident. And then I read up and, you know, I understand the mechanics behind how it works. And previously, it was not illegal because I had mentioned it did not change a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon. The mechanics didn't change. But it should be noted that today, August 4th, the NRA released a statement to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms. They want bump stocks to have higher scrutiny, and they would like some legislation passed to make them harder to obtain because, as you just said,
you
Japs,
know it's completely worthless when the NRA is like, yeah, these are kind of fucked up.
Yeah, like when exactly.
When the NRA comes out, I'm like, this has to do with weapons, but they're pretty fucked up. Like,
well, there's no reason for someone to have these.
How terrible they are.
Absolutely.
They're just fucking terrible. There's no reason to have one. Like, none. You can't be a logical person and be like, I need this bump stock.
I need that bump stock.
I kind of want it.
Yeah.
Like, no, you don't, dude. Like, no, you fucking don't need one.
No, it's
ridiculous.
It's, like you said, it's completely asinine. And one other thing, I mean, as we're talking about the NRA, we're talking about the Second Amendment. These people I saw coming at you saying, well, because we have the Second Amendment and people can have concealed carry, someone could have ended this right away. That is laughable.
It's
that's
just so stupid,
laughable.
Man.
Look, because let's break this down. Let's break this down Barney style. Okay? What are you going to conceal? A handgun, maybe? And you're talking about darkness. You're talking about you don't know where that guy is firing from. And I mean, I don't know. I don't believe he had any tracers firing. So to see a muzzle flash from hundreds of yards away. And then on top of that, I'm not going to speak to handguns because I'm not an expert. I don't know what the max effective range is, but the further you get away, the less accurate you are. There's people who are very good shots with a handgun who have a tough time hitting targets that are 25 yards away. So you're going to tell me?
Shooters struggle at 25 yards
right.
with a handgun. Like to pass the concealed handgun test that you have in Tennessee, for example, you have to be 50% on target from 75 or from 25 yards. It might be 75%. But that's from 25 yards. When you're talking, if you were shooting from the ground to where this shooter was in Vegas,
among all the chaos,
I'm not a big geometry guy, but you'd be about 500 yards if you were like at a shootable angle where you could get inside that window. Not going to happen.
No.
Even with an M16, if somebody that's very good, like a Marine or an Army or whoever, somebody that's a good shot, that's a long fucking distance shot when you're shooting upwards with wind at night, no visibility, while getting fired at. That's an incredibly difficult shot. So even if everybody with their concealed weapon was carrying long guns like an AR-15, it would be an incredibly difficult thing to stop. It's just fucking stupid, man. Like, if you say that kind of thing, you're stupid. And I read a comment that was in our iTunes that somebody called us MSZBT, which first of all is a world-class insult because
yeah,
people
seriously.
Think that I'm like lib chaps and shit like that. But we have never once said that we were against guns or anything
no.
like that. We're for responsible gun ownership.
Absolutely.
I like hunting. I like people that go out and hunt. I go buy my deer from people who hunt. I don't like to shoot, not because I hate guns. I don't like doing it because after I got shot, I don't like to be around guns. I think that that's a normal response.
I would say
so. I'm not going to go out and just hang out around guns that day.
It's probably not going to invoke good memories for you. And I will go on record, and I believe I said it earlier in the show, and when I say earlier, many, many episodes ago, we were talking about school shootings. I support the Second Amendment. I think it's fine if you want to hunt responsibly and you pass a background check responsibly. But to say that these people need these high-powered weapons will never pass the smell test for me. I don't think it's necessary to have these types of weapons in any sort of recreational fashion.
No, I don't either. And some people will make the argument that if you work in security or something like that, you need it. But if you do need somebody to work in security and you're that important, you can find somebody who's qualified by using ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is the place where you can post over 100 different leading job boards with just one click. ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get quality candidates in just one day. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/zero. You'll try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/zero. I've been rewatching West Wing. I think I've told you that. I think
yeah,
talked
you've
about
been,
it a little bit.
You've been hot on the West Wing.
There is a line I want young Brendan to put in to the podcast right here, because I think that there is a very good distinction that Miss Ainsley Hayes makes in West Wing, where she talks. They have an argument about guns right after Josh Lyman and President Bartlett get shot. There's a presidential shooting, and they go through all these different steps. Sam Seaborn explains why he thinks that guns should be more restricted, and Ainsley Hayes explains why she doesn't. We're going to listen to that now. Not that.
Definitely not that.
All right, so you can...
That's all you said. Huh? You only told me about the Barney stuff.
I know.
What else
I did this on the fly. I'll send you this link, too.
I'll cut this.
Yeah.
That they are cold and mean and racist, and then accuses Republicans of using the politics of fear. This White House that loves the Bill of Rights, all of them, except the second one.
This is the wrong place to talk about guns right now. I thought your column was idiotic.
Imagine my surprise.
But for a brilliant surgical team and 2 centimeters of a miracle, this guy's dead right now. From bullets fired from a gun bought legally. They bought guns, they loaded them, they drove from Wheeling to Roslyn, and until they pulled the trigger, they had yet to commit a crime. I am so off the charts tired of the gun lobby tossing around words like personal freedom and nobody calling them on it. It's not about personal freedom. And it certainly has nothing to do with public safety. It's just that some people like guns.
Yes, they do. But you know what's more insidious than that? Your gun control position doesn't have anything to do with public safety, and it's certainly not about personal freedom. It's about you don't like people who do like guns. You don't like the people.
All right, so that's where I want to stop right there. I like you as people. Like, if you like guns, I don't hate you, dude. Like, there's a difference between being... Like, I think we need to be more responsible and being insidious and hating the people who like guns. That's not how I am. I'm not like that at all. And Connor, you're not either.
No, not at all. I know plenty of pals of mine who are hunters, gun enthusiasts, and they have all of their weapons legally. And that's what they enjoy doing. I just don't enjoy it for whatever, you know, don't get me wrong. Firing all the different types of weapons I've got to fire during my military career was really cool. But I guess I just never had like a real hankering to have my own weapons and go out on the weekends and fire them. So I don't hate those people, though.
No, I don't either. And one of the reasons why I don't have like crazy ass guns is not just because I think that they're irresponsible on some level, but also because they're very expensive. If you want guns, and right now they're illegal to get basically whatever you want to, as long as it's not a fully automatic weapon and you need the money to do it, I would suggest trying out making money on DraftKings. You can go to DraftKings right now and use the promo code CHAPS to play in a free contest where you can get $100,000 this Sunday. That promo code CHAPS to compete for a share of $100,000 in total prizes. The contest is totally free to enter. Why wouldn't you try? DraftKings, the game inside the games. Eligibility restrictions apply. I would not go with Blake Bortles. Don't start Blake Bortles because he's been making me sad. But anybody else, probably you'll probably do well. Just don't go with Blake Bortles. DraftKings.com. Right now, we're going to have Jack come on the show. Here is Jack.
Before we started talking, we mentioned that we're Marines, which gets in Connor's crawl a little bit.
Not too much, just a little.
Well, I like to talk shit to him all the time. But what was it about the Marine Corps that made you want to become a leader of Marines?
You know, I grew up, my early childhood was in the 50s, and my world was filled with vets. My dad served in the Navy in World War II, and my uncle served in the Army Air Corps in World War II. And, so I was surrounded by vets. The neighborhood we were from on the south side of Chicago was all filled with guys that came back from both that and Korea. And so, you know, I mean, maybe it was John Wayne movies or something, but the Marine Corps, and they had cool uniforms, and I just thought, you know, I want to be one of those guys. And I'm glad I did. You know, it was one of the best choices I ever made in my life, and the Marines never disappointed me. The guys that they let me lead, if that was the right term, I mean, they were just ready to go. And so I was glad I was with them, and it was a great experience for me.
It's always pretty interesting to talk to Marines, no matter what generation they're a part of, because they always mention the clothes. Like, the uniform is, like, one of the main things. You wouldn't think that the guys would be so concerned about it, but you talk about the dress blues, and every single Marine's face lights up. It's something that you never lose pride of, especially when you have the blood stripe down the trousers. It makes a big difference.
Right. No, it's a big draw. I got a kick out of when John Glenn died, one of the guys that he went through OCS with was somebody that said, well, John and I joined the Marines because they had cool uniforms. You know, so
it's just so damn true. So,
it's true. Uniform. You guys definitely have us beat in the Army. I will admit that.
We're very vain.
So walk us through what your job responsibilities were while you were on active duty.
In those days, I joined the Marine Corps. I went to OCS in 1967, late in the year, and by mid-1968, I was in Vietnam as an infantry officer, and I was a platoon leader. And, I just had three squads, a reinforced squad, so probably about 40 guys that I went to battle with. And, I was part of a company, and the company leader played football at Florida State. He was a great guy, and he was a great captain and company commander, and we were pretty good. The way we worked, we were in the northwest corner of Vietnam, no Viet Cong. It was all North Vietnamese regulars, conventional warfare, and at that time, they were closing bases like Khe San and Khon Tien because the strategy was, let's get our Marines moving to go find them rather than wait for them to find us. And so we'd go out on patrols for a week or 2 weeks at a time and sleep on the ground. And that was worse than anything. It was, it was hot and it was muggy and you wear the same clothes for a couple of weeks and you couldn't stand each other after a while. So it's, when we go back, it was great to get in showers and drink cold beer and things like that. But it was, not a lot of people came with us in terms of reporters because they didn't like the fact that they couldn't go back somewhere at night and get a cold beer.
So I think I speak for Connor, too. Our generation really are one of our only where we could wrap our minds around what happened in Vietnam is based on the movies that are going on with Vietnam. So when you say that you were out for a week or two at a time, I automatically picture the scenes from Forrest Gump where Bubba and Forrest have their heads leaning up against each other. There's stinging rain, all that stuff. Is that kind of how it was really like?
That was. And, when it rained, it really rained. And oddly enough, with all that rain, we had trouble getting water, because it rained a couple of months a year. But we operated along the ridge lines because that's where literally there were roads. There were so many well-worn paths. And so we'd go on that hoping to run into somebody. And but when you're operating on the ridge lines, you had to walk down these mountains to get water in the streams. And then you had to worry about what was in the water. And, we had things we could put in the water to purify them. But, it was really survival out there. And, what's really strange is how well we adapt to things. I mean, after a while, we just went with it. And I think everybody did. And, we'd be soaking wet and that's just the way it was. So.
Right. I think so many times people ask guys who have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, how do you deal with the extreme temperatures? And it's the same thing. You just that becomes the norm. So if you're dealing with extreme weather and things of that nature, then what became your biggest challenge as a leader when you would go out on those long patrols?
It was I was lucky. I mean, as bad as all that sounded, down south, these guys could go to the rear area and there'd be people there that could get them drugs and things like that. My guys were clean and not that they didn't have it in them to get in trouble, but we were out in a place where we couldn't get in trouble.
Marines, they're gonna find somewhere.
That's right. But, if they went to the rear, that's where they get in fights and things like that. And it was just but my biggest challenge basically was, you'd start slogging through that stuff and is to keep them sharp, inspect the weapons every day to make sure they were going to work if they needed them. And make sure they were sharp when the situation required it. And they were good, and they respected that. And when we'd set in at night, they'd cut fields of fire and everything. I mean, they were really good. They were trained so well. And I kid about the Army, but there were Army units up I worked with a little bit, and they were great. And so we were all in the same, and they were mainly in the rear areas because it was like 5th Mech and people like that that I worked with. Mm-hmm. They had great toys.
I want to point something out mid-interview just about the nature of Marine officers and officers in general. We've been talking for a little bit, and everything that Jack has been saying is pointing highlights on his men, not on himself. And that is the nature of leadership. So you see that whenever you have experienced combat officers, especially or senior enlisted, that they will put the spotlight on their people, not themselves. It's almost like how Bill Belichick does it. If Bill Belichick's team wins, then his players get off their credit. If they don't win, then he takes the blame. And you're kind of seeing that now. But I want to transition and make it about you for a minute. Your son told me a story about how you got a Purple Heart. Can you explain what happened to you that day?
Yeah, we had these hilltops all through those mountains, which were fire support bases, and they had an artillery unit on it, and we'd patrol for a week, and then we'd swap with another unit, and we'd provide security in one of these places so we could just take our boots off for a while and everything else. And one of these places was a place called Fire Support Base Argonne, and they had lifted the artillery off there, but it was still a hotbed. We knew there was a lot of infiltration there and everything. And we landed there, and sure enough, they were all over the place, the NVA. And as I said, no Viet Cong, North Vietnamese regulars. And they held a ridge line, and they shot down a helicopter on the upper landing zone. So we were on the lower ground, and there was a company of Marines up there along with us. And they did a good job of fighting their way up the hill and securing the top of the hill. And that's courageous stuff. And I wasn't part of that assault. But, later on, I went up there, and we had a battalion commander that said to me, get to the top of the hill and just find out what the hell is going on up there. And so I did. And a couple of kids had been shot, and, I helped get them down. And I noticed at the time that there was, when I talked about Las Vegas and how that report of that rifle made me think of an M60, I went over the edge of one of the hilltops, and there was a kid there just leaning on his M60, just fighting away. And you could see the ground kicking up around him. And I just thought, this kid is just doing great, And, because, his head was right there, and mm-hmm. I'm sure that was the target. There was another kid next to him that was helping him out, and he was firing his M16. And there was another kid that was laying next to his M16 that wasn't firing at all. I mean, he was a casualty. And so I went down. At that time, I had the 81 mortars under my command, and I just said, let's get these guys some help. And so we started chucking rounds out there, and we silenced a lot of the gunfire that was going at him. What happened was that was day one. And day two, we woke up, and we were sitting there having our coffee, and a friend of mine, Andy O'Sullivan, was an artillery officer, and we were sitting down plotting where we're going to do targets with the artillery that he could call in, and with my mortars, which we could fire closer to the hill. And the NVA must have had a target set up, because they fired a round. It landed right, an 81 round. It landed right in the middle of the hill, sprayed across me, sprayed across Andy, killed our battalion commander, wounded our first sergeant. I mean, it got everybody in the command group. And so that's how I got it. And, one of those things where I wasn't doing anything courageous. I was just sitting there doing my job. They should have left me alone. They didn't.
That's about mine, too.
Yeah.
Same exact situation.
I didn't get hurt that badly, but I was knocked out. The concussion, I mean, it was like 10 feet away, but I was sitting a little bit lower. So the shrapnel kind of raked across me rather than hit me directly. And so I was lucky. So was Andy. The colonel wasn't quite so lucky. And that was it. I went back. I was medevaced. I got back, and I said, I'm ready to go back. I got guys up there. And so I got the next helicopter out and was right back in the field, and like any guy would have done. And we kept the hill, and, that was it for my Purple Heart. That simple.
Well, thank you very much for your service, and we appreciate you telling that. I know that sometimes those stories can be incredibly difficult. They're incredibly difficult for me to share So we really want to thank you for doing that. I think that has been one of the hallmarks of the Vietnam War, especially older veterans, not just Vietnam, but Korea and World War II as well. Older veterans have always kind of been shy about, not really shy, but hesitant on telling their personal stories. And I think that that's something that whenever you do it, we talk about that it's a library of you. That story now will live on, and like your great grandkids will be able to listen to it. And I think that that's a wonderful thing. There's a new documentary that's on PBS that that is going through the Vietnam War. I believe it's 18 hours long of a complete documentary.
Right.
You had some thoughts that you wanted to discuss with us about the documentary.
Well, I know, first let me respond to the other one about telling stories. For me, it all depends on the audience. I mean, if I'm talking to somebody that never served and they want me to tell them more stories, they're not going to hear anything.
Sure.
You know, so it's people that can appreciate what it is. You know, sometimes it's real simple, sometimes it's real complicated, but for me, it's who I'm talking to. So moving on, Ken Burns. I went to the screening of it. I think I told you I was out of the country for a while, so I haven't really seen a lot of it. But I have the book. There's a big book done, and it's done very well. I appreciate what Ken Burns did because it's probably the only objective view we're going to get about the Vietnam War, you know, because once our regular media gets a hold of things, everybody puts their own spin on it and everything else. My friend Carl Marlantis, who was a Navy Cross winner and a Rhodes Scholar, he was one of the guys that gave input to it. And another guy named Tim O'Brien wrote a book called The Things They Carried, which is a great book. I'd recommend it to anybody.
I actually read that in school. It is a fantastic book. I would also recommend it.
Yeah, if, you know, we'll talk a little bit about PTSD in a second, but there's a great chapter on that in there. But, you know, when I look at that, you know, all I thought about was it was 50 years ago that a lot of us fought in Vietnam. You know, we got home. We had issues because we weren't welcomed home at all. And not only that, but we all had PTSD, just like guys that served in Iraq and Afghanistan did. You know, they came home and then everybody's life was going on. And, you know, you're thinking, where do I fit in all this? And that's a big problem. And, you know, the way I fit in maybe is to go to a bar and just drink a lot. And or, you know, just get in arguments with my wife if I was married or something like that. It's this guy that I'm talking about in the book that Tim O'Brien had is, he lived on a lake and he kept on driving around the lake in the big circle time after time, looking at an old girlfriend's house, looking at this. And he said, just where do I go? And his conclusion was, you know, maybe I kind of died over there. And, you know, that's when people really begin to sink. And so, you know, these guys come home, they deal with their issues. They get married, a lot of them. They get a career. They have families. They have grandkids and everything else. And it was a tough time for him, and now somebody has to stir that pot again and to bring it all back. And, you know, being an officer, I was lucky. I had doors open for me with people that would hire me. But for the, you know, for kids that were 18 to 19 years old, maybe they didn't understand so well. And I think it had to be tough on them. And so that's who I worry about. I'm sure that that Burns did a great job on this. He does a great job on everything he does. I'm sure it's objective. But, you know, I don't like it being objective. I want him to tell my story or our story.
Right. And that's something that was a common thing when Band of Brothers came out, too, that there was people from that generation that just were like, man, we're just moving. Like, we feel like we just moved past, and now you're kind of, like, twisting the knife again.
Yeah. So that was my complaint with it. And I guess, you know, if you're going to be totally objective, we had to be casualties again. And so that's how I kind of feel about it. But my friend Carl, again, was one of the advisors of that, and so was Tim O'Brien. And I know that Burns had great input on how he did it and what he did. But it took him 10 years to put it together.
And you mentioned your friend Carl, who you said won a Navy Cross. And for those that are listening that don't know what a Navy Cross is, I believe off the top of my head it's the nation's third highest award for valor if you're in the if you're inside the Marine Corps or the United States Navy.
Yeah, I think the Marine Corps is second highest.
Second,
I don't know anything.
That's right. Yep. Jesse Puller, 5 Navy Crosses. Should have screamed that at boot camp one more time. Maybe I'd have remembered off the top of my head.
Something none of us will ever see. But
his platoon was trapped on a hill one day, and your son wanted me to ask you about that story.
This is he wrote a book called Matterhorn, which sold pretty well. Now, it's been out for about 6 or 7 years, I think. But he wrote Matterhorn, and he based it on his experiences there. It was a novel, but he based it on his experiences there. they were on a hill. He and his company were on a hill, and the same hill, they evacuated, and then they went back, and they had to retake it because the NVA had dug in using their bunkers on that hill. And it was key. And at the time we were set up, I was a little bit south of him, and another group was on a hill just a little bit east of him. But, you know, I was very familiar with the assault, and we could even see it with binoculars. And he was at the base of the hill, and he had to attack up that hill. And at one point, you know, and he was a friend of mine. At one point, they said he was a Coors, which meant he was killed. He was wounded, had shrapnel in his eye, and he was knocked out. And he came to, and he got up, and he stood up, and he led his platoon up to take the top of the hill. It was amazing. And they were dug in, and he got them right off the hill. I mean, one of the funniest things is my friend Andy O'Sullivan was our forward observer, and he called in an 8-inch gun round on the top of that hilltop to clear the way, and the round didn't explode, but it went right into the parapet of one of the bunkers, didn't explode, and we're thinking, well, the guys died of fright anyway. But you know, it was that was one of the humorous things. But there was a helicopter shot down on the hill, and you know, these guys.
The idea of humor is pretty fucked up.
Yeah, well,
that's
you do
one of the humorous things. It's a gun run comes that doesn't blow up. You're like, that's pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, that's how we exist, yeah. You know. But it's you know, he got to the top of the hill, he took it, and you know, as far as I'm concerned, that's worthy of the Navy Cross. You know what? Another thing about Marine humor is, my friends and I were kidding him about the fact that if he only got killed, he would have gotten the Medal of Honor. You know, so
we talked about that with Kyle Carpenter on that. That it's kind of screwed up now. What you have to do to get, like, if you're alive, you're probably not going to get the Medal of Honor. I mean, since we've been at Afghanistan for 15 years in Iraq, and there's only two living Marines with the Medal of Honor. And
yeah.
I think that's wrong. Like, there's plenty of other stories that rate that award. Like, it shouldn't be the Hope Diamond. Like, if you go that far outside of your rank and responsibility, you deserve it. Like, you really do.
Yeah. Well, the fact that I thought he was dead, I mean, when they said now he's leading the charge, I thought, thank God he's alive, you know, and I thought now he can get killed for real. But he deserved it. He's the real deal.
And he deserves to have that story told again now, and your story to be told again now. So let me ask you, with this documentary, and I've seen a couple hours, I haven't seen the full 18 hours because that's a very long documentary.
Right.
But it's been fascinating for me as a history buff, also as someone who has served. But do you think now in 2017, seeing this documentary shown, it's almost good because of the appreciation that our country in general has for the military, and hearing these stories again and honoring these men and women who served back then, it's almost a good thing that we're telling this story again now.
Yeah, you know, the fact that it's objective, I think history will get a good look at it, and the fact that he included in it the fact that we were mistreated when we came home, and even had a few people that were part of the massive demonstrations that said, you know, I can't believe we did that to these guys, you know. So it's, you know, I think it's all forgiven. You know, for me, it's a time that I don't want to really relive. And but, you know, I appreciate the work they did. And, you know, kids that want to study the history of these wars will get a good view of exactly what it was like and why we did it and why we shouldn't have done it.
So you're pretty passionate about PTSD. Can you kind of explain to us why that's an issue close to your heart?
You know, it's because I think everybody has it. And, you know, Connor, you probably know a lot of guys that kept on going back and back and back for another tour of duty. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, why do they do that? You know, it's because that's their life. You know, you go over there, you train, you're trained well, you get an idea of what you should do. And then you get there and you're pretty good at your job. And and you get some satisfaction of working with these guys that you admire so much. And all of a sudden you go home and it's a different world and you don't fit in. And unless you really work at fitting in, it's going to be a problem. And, you know, so I think, you know, when this kid in that book, The Things They Carried, when he said, you know, I might have died over there, well, he wound up committing suicide. And because he couldn't come to grips with what it was like being home and being part of society again. And, you know, girlfriend was married, his friends all had jobs, that kind of stuff. And he was from a small town. There were no distractions. And and a lot of guys, you know, I probably drank more than I should have when I got home. And first it was being a big party guy and Second, it was like, you know, I don't fit in. But, you know, I got over it pretty quick, but some guys didn't.
And it wasn't the easy route like we have here. And I don't want to say easy, but the level of support that we've gotten from the Iraq and Afghanistan generation compared to what you guys got, I think it's more common for us to talk about what happened than it was for you all. It was like when you all came back, you almost had to eat it. And now whenever you see veterans out with their veterans hats, it's almost gone full circle where it seems like a lot had to be really almost felt ashamed of what they did in Vietnam whenever they came back. And now it's gone full circle where you can't go on base without seeing 70,000 Vietnam vets with their hats on that say the Vietnam War on it.
Yeah. You know, the thing about it is I've been to I'm active with a lot of veterans organizations here, and, you know, they have these dinners and everything. And when I meet somebody that's in uniform and they ask me, you know, was I in the Marine Corps when I was in the Army, whatever, and I tell them who I served with and where I served. And the first thing they say is, welcome home. And, you know, it still gets me. And, you know, the people remember that and remember to say that and know that we got treated poorly. So, you know, it's everything's forgiven. As I said, it just the whole thing when it comes up in a documentary, it's tough for me to see. But, you know, I think it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. So we usually end our show on save rounds and alibis. But I want to give you the opportunity if you have any save rounds or alibis, if there's anything else that you wanted to talk to us about.
You know, just this whole thing about guns and everything, you know, I'm a Second Amendment guy, I think, but I do believe in background checks. I don't want idiots to have guns. And I don't think anybody, any civilian has any reason to own an M16 or, you know, an AR-15, whatever you want to call them, or an M4 or anything else. You know, I like to hunt, and a shotgun does plenty with that. And if I'm going to protect my home or protect myself or family or anything else, a handgun will do just fine. And, you know, but to arm these guys to the teeth, especially, you know, when I think of the terrorists that come to this country and can get their hands on this kind of stuff, I mean, it just drives me crazy. You know, if somebody wants to limit some of the Second Amendment things, that's fine with me. I mean, nobody envisioned we'd have this kind of weaponry when they wrote that Second Amendment. So that's how I feel. And I'll get a lot of pushback from my guys. You
know? We're going to dive really far deep into guns in just a little bit. But we wanted to thank you. And both of us pretty much agree. I mean, there's little technical differences here or there, but we agree. Well, Captain Higgins, thank you so much for coming on our show. We really appreciate you taking the time and telling your story. I know that sometimes that's really difficult, and we really appreciate your service, sir. Thank you.
I appreciate it. And congratulations on your success. Your show's doing great.
Love talking to Vietnam vets, man. Like, Vietnam vets, just so fucking humble, and I think part of it's just because of what they had to endure. They went through some serious shit and got treated like absolute ass.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. One thing I would like to reiterate, the book that Captain Higgins mentioned, The Things I Carried by Tim O'Brien, he also wrote another book, If I Die in a Combat Zone. I've read both of those if you're looking for book recommendations.
And fuck me up and send me home.
There you go.
Lay my medals across my chest. Tell my mama that I did my best. And I bet you $10 to this very day when I hit the ground. You're gonna hear me say, whoa, yeah, run, we motivated.
Whoa, yeah. That was the
Anytime I hear Lay My Medals Across My Chest, you gotta do it.
That was the Colton Cadence segment of the show that we might need to incorporate weekly now. But yeah. Great books, and again, thanks to Captain Jack Higgins for coming on with such an awesome name and such an awesome story. Really appreciate his appearance.
Any save rounds, alibis?
Well, before we even get to that, I got a couple badasses of the week that I feel need to mention. Obviously, we did our breakdown of Band of Brothers, so we would be remiss. And thank you to all those who sent us links and reminded us. We lost Don Malarkey, Sergeant Don Malarkey. You'll remember he was one of the great NCOs during Band of Brothers. He was the oldest living survivor of Easy Company until he passed this week. So we mourn his passing. And then also this week, we had the anniversary of Black Hawk Down, the Battle of Mogadishu on October 3rd. And it was important enough for me to mention, I thought that we should mention the Medal of Honor recipients from that battle. Master Sergeant Gordon and Sergeant First Class Shugart, Gary Gordon and Randy Shugart. You'll remember they were the two operators who requested to be put down on Mike Durant's bird to protect him, knowing full well that they had no other backup and that they were it. Whatever they had on them in terms of ammunition was what they had, but they felt it was their duty to get put down in that combat zone and protect him. And they unfortunately lost their lives that day, but they did so gallantly. So I'd like to remember them this week with our other badass of the week.
Well, yeah, there we go.
Save rounds.
I don't know where the fuck to go. Yeah. Save rounds.
Save rounds. So, alibis.
I'm excited. I'll be in studio next week. We have big interviews coming up. We're going down to have Cons and I both will be down in D.C. at a little place called the Capitol Building. We're going to be interviewing some congressmen, hanging out with some people who are on the Veterans Affairs committees. So it should be pretty little interesting interview for you guys next week.
Chaps, let me ask you a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
What are you going to wear to the Capitol?
I don't know, dude. I texted my wife earlier today. I was like, I got to go shopping. All I got's like T-shirts and Barstool shit.
Yeah.
I got to go get a haircut because it'll be the first time in like 4 years that I don't wear a hat. It's going to be weird.
Yeah. I was wondering what you were going to have to do. I think you're okay with the beard, but you're definitely going to have to clean it up and look sharp. But we can get you fitted out and figure something out good for you. The only save round alibi, I would like to point out that you wrote a great blog because there was a gentleman who...
Was it one of my audio blogs?
It was not, but gosh, I love those new audio blogs.
Yeah,
and I'm really proud of how well you can read these days. Hot in the streets. And we get to see your
handsome
face.
Can we talk about how good I read on the opening ad?
Dude, I was going to say, that's your new thing, reading well. Really proud of you.
I love to read. I'm a big-time reader.
But you wrote, about just going back to the Vegas incident, there was one gentleman who posted on his Instagram, and he has millions of followers, about how he was reacting to the situation and that how he went back to get his guns and get back to
Dan
the situation.
Dan Bilzerian is his
name. That's his name. I just didn't want to give him the credit again. But then he reacted because Dakota Meyer, and if you don't know that name, it's... You should. He is one of the living Medal of Honor recipients. He had some choice words for Dan. And then shame on Dan for dismissing him as some Marine. You know who he is. There's two Medal of Honor recipients. You know who that guy is. I just thought that was extremely disrespectful. And Chaps, you made the right point. It's one thing to say, like, hey, man, you don't know how you would have reacted in that situation because you weren't in that situation. And that's fair to an extent. But to disrespect Dakota's service and his gallant actions that earned him that Medal of Honor was completely distasteful. And I think Blazarian is a complete ass. And I have no problem saying that to his face if he'd like to come to the Barstool office. So bravo to you, Chaps, for addressing... Bye. for addressing that situation and, as always, knocking it out of the park.
So there's another little thing that came up on Instagram today that I saw Blazarian, like, out there asking a cop to give him his fucking weapon so he could, like, assault the building with a pistol, like a service pistol. Get the fuck out of here. We already talked about how ridiculous that is. It's showboating. Like, good on you, dude. You weren't, like, running away, like, which I don't care about anyway. If you're unarmed at a concert, running away is nothing to be ashamed of.
No.
And two, Blazarian, calling somebody submarine, being called even the most generic Marine is not a fucking insult, dude. Like, we don't take that as an insult. My favorite thing, one of my favorite things that I ever heard from any four-star general is whenever General Hagee was getting ready to retire, he's a commandant of the Marine Corps. General Hagee was asked whenever he was retiring, what's the most proud thing you are of your 40-year career as a Marine Corps officer? And he said that I earned the title of Marine. Fuck you, Blazarian. Sound the retreat.